February 8th, and welcome everyone. The first thing, if everyone can turn off your cell phones, I'd appreciate it. We need to, do I open the working session? Mm-hmm. We need to open a work session on Senate Bill 1093. Yes.
Madam Chair, I move the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 1093.
Okay. Senator Gorley moves the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 1093. Those are the opinion. Or is there any opposition? Okay. So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 1093 passed out of committee.
Senator Gorley has moved we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 1093 passed out of committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Now do I?
Yes.
Okay, so we sent this bill to the floor. It was all right, but then there was an amendment that that could fit into this bill if we wanted to do that. So I said, yes, we can have the discussion. So let us call up Scott Kipper and John Powell, who will explain the amendment and if it's even feasible to do. And colleagues, I think, do we have the amendment here?
I believe you do, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, the amendment that you should have in your packet is Senate Bill 1093-2.
Yes.
And also in your packet, Madam Chair, if I might, I've attached current statute that this amendment will apply to, which is 743A, which is a section of ORS, health insurance required reimbursement. And this would, the dash 2 would be amending the highlighted section 743A 068. Thank you.
Madam Chair, good morning. My name is Scott Kipper, for the record. And members of the committee, I'm the administrator of the insurance division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And we are here today to discuss the amendment before you. I would harken back to the language that you're trying to amend, which was included in Senate Bill 8 passed last year. Senate Bill 8 essentially provided that if a policy provides coverage for cancer chemotherapy, it must provide coverage for a prescribed orally administered anti-cancer medication on a basis no less favorable than intravenously administered medication. This is provided some confusion among consumers. And what has happened is, if I could walk you through an example, if a health insurance policy has a $20 copayment benefit for oral medication, but a $50 copayment for medical treatment. In this case, if the consumer used an oral medication, they would pay $50 copayment because it's no less favorable. In other words, the benefit does default to the no less favorable medical benefit, and that has caused the confusion. And this amendment that you have before you appears to attempt to equalize that particular benefit to the lower out-of-pocket benefit, either in the situation that I described, then it would benefit or the out-of-pocket cost to the consumer would be the $20 instead of the $50.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. You have before you a letter that I received from my constituent, and I didn't mark it, but about the fourth line up from the bottom of the first paragraph, my constituent went from a $20 copay per month to a $4,000 copay per month. $4,000 is half of the cost of the pill that they are receiving. Now, I have worked very hard on trying to correct this, and I'm learning more as we go along, and in my conversations to Mr. Powell, they're on a Medicare plan, which is a federally mandate or federally controlled plan, and so this bill would not impact that program as far as you can tell. Their insurance company is a Medicaid supplemental insurance. Is that correct? To your knowledge?
Madam Chair, John Powell, representing Regents. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that's correct. The Medicare supplement plans are prescribed by the federal government, and insurers sell those plans with the benefits as prescribed.
Now you're referring to Medicare Part D.
Madam Chair, I'm referring to Medicare supplement plans, which
supplement
can include the Part D.
I need to know this.
Again, Madam Chair, I think Mr. Kipper gave you a very good background of and history of the bill, and it was a situation similar to the one that Senator Morissette described that brought Senate Bill 8 to you last session. And in terms of commercial insurance, that is regulated by the state, we resolved that issue because there was a Regents individual health plan that had a 50% pharmaceutical benefit with no stop loss. So the individuals that had that plan and had to use this drug, which was $8,000 a month, had a $4,000 a month out-of-pocket cost. Senate Bill 8 took care of that for those insured under commercial insurance. This issue, and Senator Morissette's doing more research on it, appears to perhaps deal with the donut hole as described under Part D of Medicare pharmaceutical benefit, whereby the insured is required after a very minimal benefit to pay like $3,000 or $4,000 a year before that benefit then kicks in again. So they get some benefit, and then there's this hole that they have to pay out of pocket. And it may be that issue in this case. I don't know that that's the case because we just don't have all the information yet.
Because I know Senator Morissette, and that's why he was wondering if that could possibly a change be made to this bill, and so we will work on that. We know that the amendments aren't here. I will carry this bill over to Monday, but if things are not resolved by Monday, the bill will have to go through as is. But do you want to address
the amendments?
Yes,
Madam Chair. Again, John Powell, representing Regents. Madam Chair, And I'm going to keep this simple because you can really get yourself turned around your own steering wheel on this issue because there are so many different types of health plans. But I want to talk about two situations. This would require an insurance company to determine on a particular claim or each claim came in with a prescription benefit that's affected here. They would have to determine each time they get a claim which side of the equation to apply that to, the medical benefits under the policy or the pharmaceutical benefits under the policy. Because it says you have to adjudicate the claim under the least cost, out-of-pocket cost to the consumer. The only way to determine that would be just to see where they are in their deductible payment. Because if they paid up their deductible, they're probably, on the medical side, only responsible for 20% of the cost that they're incurring after that deductible's been paid. You have to compare that to the copay they're paying. So as the year goes by and they pay their deductible up, which side you would adjudicate that claim on might change. That would require pulling those claims out, which is almost impossible because these claims are now done by computers in pharmacies. So our insured goes in to get a prescription. They give the pharmacist the script, and the pharmacist enters that in the computer, and that is figured based on the policy plan and benefit plan, and the consumer doesn't have to pay that money and get reimbursed later. Under this proposal, the only way we could administer it is to have them pay for it at the site and then reimburse them. Again, a very time-consuming and manual process that would be very expensive. So we don't see this as a real potential solution to any problem, but create many more problems and increase costs.
Okay. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've had conversations about this and emails from a friend of mine who's in the insurance business. And, you know, we thought with eight we had a perfect solution, and we may or may not. But I think at this point in time, I mean, the bill went into effect in January. It's now February. And so we don't really have enough data, enough experience on the ground to really know what impacts are going to be system-wide. And my fear is that in attempting, in such a short, condensed time frame, to fix a problem that we don't fully understand yet, we might end up making it worse. And so it would be my advice that we take a hard look at it next year, when we've had a whole year under our belt and a better idea of what the impacts have been.
And that may be what we'll have to do, but we still, I think, need to see what we can come up with. And I see Legislative Council, Lori, back there to see if we can meet the needs. Yes.
Madam Chair, if I might, I was going to make 2 points. One was the difficulty with administering it. The other issue is some employers and group plans buy their pharmaceutical benefit from one insurer and their medical from another. And they're two separate companies, and that, I'm told, is somewhat frequent now, because they're such good shoppers and try to save money, so they will actually split the package and have two separate companies providing the benefits, which again would make this all but impossible to administer under that circumstance.
Senator Morrison.
Yeah, thank you. Have you written, Scott, have you written administrative rules for this?
Senator Moore said, Madam Chair, we have not written administrative rules on Senate Bill 8 yet.
Okay. That might be a solution, an interim solution, is to work on the rules to try to solve this issue. And then if we need legislation, we could come back. But I think something needs to be done between now and then. And you know, I think rules are need to be done.
Okay. Any further? Yes, Senator Gordley.
A question in a different direction, Madam Chair. This measure exempts the Oregon Health Fund Board from certain public contracting requirements. My question is, where specifically is the exemption language in the bill, and what requirements are being exempted? Is it Section 6? That covers that exemption.
Oh, we are okay. We're going back to the original. Where? Let's finish up with them first. We probably won't. Yeah. Any further questions dealing with the amendment? With the dash two amendments. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now we're going to go back to the dash one amendment.
Right.
And if we can find those.
Do we have that one? Yeah, that was what we passed out.
We passed out, yes.
You need a copy, sir?
Right now I do need it.
Okay. I believe I have one.
That was dropped at our desk. Right?
The dash ones we...
On Monday.
Right.
The dash ones on Monday.
I mean, on Wednesday.
Okay.
Wednesday or Monday?
Okay. Thank you. Someday this week, earlier.
Yeah. No, it was Wednesday. We didn't even meet Monday.
Excuse me. Right. It was Wednesday.
That was earlier this week.
Wednesday. Okay. Okay, the question, she wants to know that it exempts the Oregon Health Fund Board from certain public contracting requirements. She wanted to know what those requirements are. And so we do not have someone here to address that issue, I don't believe, but we are going to be carrying this bill over till Monday, and Sandy will make sure that someone is here to address that statement. Is that all right?
Yep, that's fine. It's and what specific language in the bill deals with the exemptions? Is it Section 6, or is it buried someplace else?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Lori Freeman is sitting there chomping at the bit waiting to come up and help us on this.
Lori, could you just come up and...
And Madam Chair, just as a little research, in Mr. Spate's letter explaining the needs, he says, a manner in which Sections 24 and 25 were written, as interpreted by the Attorney General's office, effectively nullified the exemption granted in Section 7 since the appropriation to the board under section was made to the... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm reading the wrong one. He does speak to the public contracting requirements in the letter that he has submitted asking for this amendment.
In the original bill, the 329.
Are you...
329.
You are looking at...
329 or...
What river?
So that's in 329, and I don't have 329 in front of me, and so I think we need to wait until Monday to address this.
The amended bill has no Section 6.
No. Yes. Lori.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from the Office of Legislative Counsel. It was Section 7 of the Senate Bill 329, which I believe is Oregon Laws Chapter 697, that exempted the actions of the board from the requirements, the public contracting requirements, so that would be the bidding and all that sort of thing. The way the bill is set up, absent this amendment, is for the first year, in other words, for 2008, the money was appropriated to DHS, because the board was put inside of DHS, so that DHS could do all of the things that they need to do to get this plan going, and DHS is subject to public contracting.
Did that explain your...
Somewhat. I will want a more detailed answer to the question. Again, specifically, what requirements are exempted? When we say bidding of what type of contracts? I mean, that's a huge exemption in public contracting. So what are the implications? Perhaps that discussion took place around Senate Bill 329, but I would like to know what the implications are here. And my guess is that we didn't have a huge discussion of this issue around Senate Bill 329.
And Barney Spate will be here. Evidently, he gets back today, so he will be here on Monday, and or whoever else can speak for him. So, okay.
No, thank you for
all right. All right. With that, we will carry this bill over. Do I close the session? Okay. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1093, and I'd like to open a public hearing on... Oh, before we go, yeah, we had amendments on for Senate Bill 1075. We have an amendment. But we still don't have the fiscal. And what I've heard from the agency is they need to change what it was, the fiscal, and so they're still working on that. So I'd like to carry Senate Bill 1075 over till Monday. And Senate Bill 1089, the same thing. The amendments are not ready. And so we will be carrying that bill over till Monday also. So for those of you... Yes, we will be busy on Monday. And so now I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1100, and we need to get Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson on the phone, and if Senator Atkinson can come forward.
Issues here, or did they just didn't get done? Okay. No, I'm 89, but 70. Yeah, as long as they don't get done.
Yeah, well, Nickel says the cost can be absorbed.
Okay.
Just so
so we're going to get a different
response. So we'll get a different response.
So we can go on the floor.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We should probably.
That's a beautiful thing. Yeah.
Do you want to? Do you like Dr. Knight Richardson on the phone?
Yeah, let's before Jason starts, let's get Dr. Knight Richardson.
We were gonna go together.
This isn't a fishing trip. Maybe it is, I don't know.
Catherine, this is Sandy from the Senate Health and Human Services Committee calling for Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson. Thank you.
That's peaceful.
Put us in the mood.
I'd suggest AC/DC rather than classical.
Hello?
Hi, Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson.
Speaking.
Yes, this is Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, and we have just opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 1100, and Senator Morissette is here, Senator Avell Gordley, and Senator Jeff Cruz are here, and at the dais is Senator Atkinson. So who would like to go first?
I'll go first, Madam Chair, and... Right. And then I think Dr. Knight Richardson can fill in on some of the specifics. For the record, I'm Jason Atkinson, State Senator from District 2. This is a bill that many of you are familiar with because I introduced the measure last year, and it has to do with providing mental health services through a mechanism that Dr. Knight Richardson largely has championed around the rest of the United States called telemedicine. I think one of the pushes for me on this bill has been serving in representing two counties that are about to be hit particularly hard by the ONC funds, or the lack of timber payments coming from the federal government. And as most of you know, those counties, when those funds are jeopardized, one of the first things to go is services to health and human services to people who need it the most, namely mental health. And I know as Senator Gordley and Senator Cruz and certainly Senator Morissette is very familiar with, one of the first areas to go is mental health services. And so the impetus of this bill was, how could we use what is being used so successfully around the country, how could we put that to work for us here in Oregon? So as Dr. Knight Richardson will tell you about how we wrote the bill very closely with Medicaid so that there was no interface problems at all with that, how we wrote this as an opt-in program, it's not a mandate. He will also tell you about the clinical nature of this, so this isn't a physician making a phone call from their home. This is actually very closely controlled to the highest standards. But in so doing, Madam Chair, members of the committee, there has been some opposition that has come up. And the opposition, namely, has made three cases. The first case is, why can't we just work on this in the interim? Madam Chair, this is the interim, and I'm working on it now. We introduced the bill last year, and we are doing it again. I really don't believe that we need to waste any more time with interim work groups because, as we know, especially from the southern parts of the state, we're in great jeopardy of losing our mental health services that are provided by the county. Number two, the next thing that comes out is, well, this is an opposition that we've all heard because we've been around this building for so long, which is, oh, this costs too much. It must have a huge fiscal. That was really, frankly, what hurt this bill last year, even though I didn't ever believe, and it was certainly never written, as Dr. Knight Richardson will tell you, that it even needed to go to fiscal because it was voluntary. It was an opt-in. And then the last part had to do certainly with reimbursement rates and the fact that, well, this is going to cost too much. Let's go through a couple of these things. Here's some of the reasons for opposition. One of the reasons for opposition to the bill is that they say this only applies to rural areas. Well, for crying out loud, that's why I wrote the bill. The next thing is this going to increase payer costs? I think the doctor will speak to this more eloquently than I, but certainly there are built into this bill, as doctor is one of the leading national experts we have on the phone with us to make sure that it was in sync with Medicare and Medicaid. There was concern that if you use a phone or a fax, you can't get reimbursed. Well, physicians don't get reimbursed for sending faxes now anyway. That's kind of a red herring. And then certainly there's some other things I think that the doctor will talk to. We, in this week alone, we have worked very closely with Oregon Health Sciences University to once again have their support. I believe you'll hear today from the Hospital and Health System Association, which I believe will say they're neutral. And you'll also hear from people that I think are opposed to the bill because of I don't know why, frankly. This bill was written to do the following, that I don't know if they're task groups or interim work groups that I have never even heard of address, which is how do you actually provide service to people who have these health needs in rural Oregon? They may be talking about red herrings of reimbursement rates. I'm actually trying to figure out how do we help counties like Josephine, Curry, Douglas, Jackson, Lake, and Klamath County. So with that, I would like to stay here and allow Dr. Knight Richardson to elaborate certainly more eloquently than I on the program and why it's working from Oregon Health Sciences University to Katrina victims, why it's working from Oregon Health Sciences University to several Native tribes, why it's working from Oregon Health Sciences University not only on the northwestern tip of Oregon but also in Umatilla County. So it's working. It's proven to work. And so the red herrings that you're hearing about, or that I have only heard about in the hall, really I don't believe are true. So with that, I would like to pass this over to Dr. Knight Richardson.
Introduce yourself, please, Dr. Knight Richardson.
Thank you, Senator Monis Anderson. I am Norwood Knight Richardson. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist who is currently serving as vice chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at Oregon Health and Sciences University. I am the director of the Division of Public Psychiatry. I'm also director and founder of the Neuropsychiatric Institute. I am director and founder of the telepsychiatry program here. And I am a trustee of the Oregon Health and Sciences University Foundation. Senators Marsat, Monis Anderson, Gordley, and Cruz, I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to you about telehealth and particularly about this bill. I first tell you that telehealth works, not just for psychiatry. It works for pediatrics. It's working for dermatology. It works for radiology. Family medicine is looking at it as well. So this is not a bill just about psychiatry. I think we in psychiatry are particularly able to use it given our modalities of treatment. This also is a bill about access. When I went to help at the request of the federal government and the governor of Louisiana in Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina, and I stayed there long enough to get caught by Hurricane Rita and fully got to appreciate what a developed the lack of a developed infrastructure for medicine can do to cause a further harm to citizens who have been deprived of health care due to a breakdown in the regular infrastructure. And one of the things that I found immediately was lacking was a vigorous, although Louisiana has a good law, did not have a vigorous support of its telehealth program. In the aftermath of that disaster, we all states said, well, what can we do to make sure we're ready for disaster? This state had numerous meetings, as you all know, from the level of the legislature and the administrative office, the governor's office, as well as the hospitals. And we also said, what can we do to make sure that we have some continuity of care? Well, one of the linchpins of that is you need to be certain that you have some telemedicine capability, not only for your doctors within the state, so that doctors exterior on the other states can provide health care through this modality. I know it works because I still see Katrina victims. In fact, I have more individual patients in Louisiana because of the need than I have here, and the federal government is sponsoring that. These people still need help. I see them every Tuesday and sometimes on Wednesdays because the numbers are so great, and they're still suffering from the aftermath of that disaster. We have had our rates of efficacy and care are comparable to face-to-face, and what we mean in-person face-to-face, because we are indeed face-to-face. I have diagnosed neurological disorders. I have diagnosed and one gentleman who was literally having a stroke in front of me. I was able to diagnose the stroke right pinpoint to the very vessel that was occluding and got him into emergency care, and he very much benefited by that. This care works, and it is not just a make do. It works in very efficacious terms in regular practice. So I want everybody to understand that part, that people who use telemedicine services are not getting inferior care when it is applied as per evidence-based practices, which the bill calls for. So you don't experiment with this modality. You use it where it has been proven to be effective. And that's along the lines of the medical specialties that I mentioned to you previously. And to go back, the bill was written, as Senator Atkinson said, to cover the needs of rural Oregon. We talk about now, we have talked about before, we will talk about it in the future, manpower shortage. What are we going to do to make sure that people in rural health care get access? Senator Alan Bates will tell you that in his practice of family medicine, over 50%, its various national studies say 60 to 80% of the people who come to family practitioners, their illness is pre-existing or either exacerbated by or caused by mental disorders. It could be depression, it could be anxiety, it could be a thought disorder, it could be a degenerative brain disorder. But it is a huge percentage of people who present. And Dr. Senator Bates will tell you that that overwhelms him in his practice. He doesn't have access to a psychiatrist. Well, this bill allows for Dr. Senator Bates to call up a psychiatrist who has telemedicine services or a facility that does, and do arrange for a telemedicine consult right there. Now, the bill provides that should Dr. Senator Bates do that, and he wants to present the case to the psychiatrist on the other end, that he gets paid for an office visit. Well, the criticism says that that's double billing. It's not. It is allowed under Medicaid right now, because Medicaid realized that there was a reluctance for clinicians to refer when they could not get their time paid for in a regular visit, because before, it prescribed. If you saw your family doctor that day and said, I was depressed and suicidal, the family doctor could not charge simultaneously for having discovered that diagnosis and talk to you and arrange for the treatment, but would have to defer his billing while the consulting psychiatrist would get paid, and that's patently unfair. And that's all this bill says, that Senator Dr. Bates could charge for an office visit. And if I saw that patient the same day, I could charge for a psychiatric evaluation. That is current Medicaid practice, so there is no double billing here. they're also under Medicare, which is a little more complex in its requirements for telemedicine and not as broad-based as Medicaid. But under Medicare even, there is what is called a facility fee, i.e., let's say you, under this bill, you are required to receive your care at one of the facilities named, which can be a hospital, a nursing facility, or a clinic, to go there and as you would for a regular doctor visit and sit in front of the camera. Well, in the past, the facility could not have any charge for arranging that, the staff time to get the patient in there to watch as we require the patient while they're doing this, not literally watch, but be outside of the door. And there's a facility fee paid by Medicaid of $25. Now, 24 states have telemedicine bills. Of those 24 states, the majority also are in line with Medicaid, and there is a facility fee of $25, which is allowed. That is the only other fee involved. There's been a criticism that this increases the cost. Well, that is a simplified analysis. The real analysis is that telemedicine in rural medicine and in specialty shortage areas saves money. Our pediatric intensivists will tell you in working with PEDS Care that we have saved tens of thousands of dollars because they are able to video and look at the sick child who is being surrounded by the team at the what we call a spoken hub. We would be the hub. There would be the spoke facility. And they would guide those physicians through procedures that they are not familiar with, thus avoiding transporting by helicopter or ambulance a child in a fragile state, probably saving morbidity, if not mortality, and definitely saving money. So in the final analysis, this bill saves money. It doesn't cost more. The economic offset is fairly immediate and can be calculated. Now, Medicaid has a clause in there that allows you to depreciate your equipment. And all that means is that if you have $10,000 of equipment and you're depreciating it over a five-year period of time, each year you get to take 20% of the cost of that and bill Medicaid for that. Because otherwise, basically against the transportation costs which Medicaid currently pays for. And so that is the economic argument. And the objections that I received, at least, seem not to understand that complexity. In the final analysis, and I will end on this final analysis, this bill also tries to assure quality. The last thing we want is for a physician, because both Medicare and Medicaid speak to quality, and they want they demand that the treatment occur in the same quality environment as would occur face to face. Now, I would not see a patient in my living room while I'm sitting in my pajamas. And we don't want doctors or any other caregiver sitting in an informal setting talking to patients in a formal setting. And you say, well, why is that? That sounds like some sort of dress code or building requirement. No, it is a lot more complicated than that. The way I've set up my program, if my computer goes down and I'm in the middle of talking to a patient who is suicidal or homicidal, I need to have a backup. Within the confines of the clinic that I've set up here, I have backup computers available. Within the confines of my clinic, let's say it is a trunk line that goes down for whatever reason, someone digging destroyed it or an electrical storm destroyed it. My next is a telephone. I have a dedicated phone that is there in case that communication is ended, the telecommunication is ended, and I continue by telephone. And the bill allows for, in that emergency, you can use the telephone, which Medicaid also allows for. The other thing is that if I fall out of my chair and can't come and do telemedicine that day, I have a backup doctor right there who can do it. These are the standards of good clinical care. It is not adding complexity to the system. It does not add. There's a specious argument here that somehow we are going to require building separate facilities. I'm not sure how they arrived at that, but it really is inaccurate thinking at a minimum. And I will end my testimony at that and be available here for any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Knight Richardson. I would like to call, before we start with the opposition to this bill, I'd like to call Gina Nichols. Well, we have one that's a neutral, too. Do you want to come up, too, neutral? John Powell. Stay there with him.
Chair Mona Sanderson, committee members, for the record, my name is Dr. Gina Nichol. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and we represent all 36 counties and the one tribe that is available to be a local mental health authority. We just wanted to put on record that the association has supported and used telemedicine for years. It's a matter of patient choice, and it's a matter of access to care. Particularly, as you have heard from Senator Atkinson, our rural areas use telemedicine. There is a dramatic lack of child psychiatrists and psychiatrists in rural Oregon, and we depend on telemedicine for that. So it makes sense for telemedicine to be a covered entity and service, not only in Medicaid, but insurance and others, and we just wanted to put on the record that we completely support Senator Atkinson and the testimony of Dr. Norwood Knight Richardson.
Thank you, Gina Nichol. Dr. Nichol. John Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Madam Chair, Regents supports telemedicine and currently pays for telemedicine under CMS guidelines. Worked with the Senator Atkinson last session, and were pleased to see that the recommendations that we made were carried forward into this bill, and we appreciate that very much. We would make one suggestion that we believe would improve the functioning of the bill, and that is the last sentence on the first page, which basically says that under rulemaking for insurance, PCBS rules would have to be identical or close to identical to those for the Medicaid program. And if you look at the breadth of the rulemaking for Medicaid under Section 4 on page 2, it's quite lengthy and thorough. And the regulation of commercial insurance might well require a different form of rule on the same subject, and because of negotiated rate making, the way rates are handled in commercial insurance and other issues. So we would simply suggest that that be eliminated, that one sentence, if that was taken out, the rules.
And which sentence is this?
It's on page 1, lines 28 through 30. Says if the director adopts rules under this section, meaning the director of the Department of Consumer Business Services, the rules must be consistent with the rules adopted by DHS under Section 4. And while consistency would obviously be taken into consideration, they're regulating two different situations and paying situations.
We'll have other insurers saying that this is actually going to be quite cumbersome, and DHS that DHS is the entity that would set the reimbursement rates, and therefore based on technology investments, and under this formula there then could be a lot of different rates for the same diagnosis and time. Is that correct? Unless they codified it.
Madam Chair, the we obviously we don't think that the Department of Human Services should set the rates for commercial health insurance. That's already regulated under the Department of Consumer and Business Services, where they have actuaries and people to review those rates. So obviously we don't think there should be dual regulation in that case. But our suggestion goes to a broader concern. This deals with rulemaking on all kinds of things other than rates as well.
All right.
So, and again, from the region's perspective, we're currently administrating payment for telehealth through by using CMS guidelines, and that's why the amendments we worked with Senator Atkinson last session tried to make sure that those guidelines and the things that Dr. Knight Richardson just explained were in the bills.
Can you address the facts issue? A fax may, and this is, we're going back to Section 4, and I'm sticking with the DHS setting the rates as well as, anyway. It says that there's a let's see. A fax may work, be less expensive, but other technologies are required, which may be more costly in telemedicine. How do you deal with the fax issue?
Which line is that?
Well,
page 2.
It's page 2, and I'm not sure where. Prohibiting the use of, down line 36-37, prohibiting the use of telephone or facsimiles when video conference technology is available. So it would be requiring video conference, but a telephone or a fax may be less money to have maybe get the cost across. So I'm wondering if this bill, if Dr. Knight Richardson has a patient and really everything can be done by a phone conference, that should be used rather than the video conference. I think that's the complaint that I'm getting from someone, that they would be required to do the video telehealth when really a phone or a fax could help deal with the patient. And you say you are covering fax and telephone or not?
Madam Chair, again, John Powell for Regents. I couldn't answer that particular question, but I assume under the guidelines that CMS has that those factors are taken into consideration, and when a fax would be appropriate in lieu of other forms of communication.
Madam Chair?
Yes, please.
May I speak? This is Dr. Knight Richardson.
Yes, please.
I think there's some confusion on this. First, let's go back. The bill addresses clinical care. This is what this is about. It is not just about communication regarding a patient. And so what it is providing for is the ability to do direct clinical care. Faxing has never been a part of direct clinical care. It is part of sharing information, but not, you can't fax and treat a patient. And that's what the confusion is. So what Medicaid said is that we're not paying for, you can't bill for clinical services by faxing information. You can't bill for telephone services by picking up the phone and giving a lab result. That lab result may be a part of a clinical treatment. Now, where telephone can, and there's still some controversy about that within my field, where telephone can be used to be billed for is in direct patient care. When you're on the phone with the patient directly, you're instructing them regarding a procedure, whether that's cleaning out an indwelling catheter or whether you're giving psychotherapy. And that indeed might be useful. But once again, I know no way to directly clinically treat a patient using a fax.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I could add just one point to that. I think if an insurance company comes up and says that that is going to cost too much a reimbursement, let me just tell you, not as a physician, but as a business person, I started a company last year. We run the whole thing, the entire thing, with three offices around the state on a product called iChat on Macintosh. And the reason we do that is cell phones cost too much, and faxes, people don't use that much anymore. We run the whole thing, and you know what iChat costs us? It's free, F-R-E-E. It's cheaper than using a phone or a fax. And so I believe that if we can just let this program get a foothold, it will quickly outgrow the complaints that are being held. I'm a bit of an outlier on technology, I get that, but we run the whole thing. Now, let me give you another example. I was running for a different office a long time ago, and when I was doing that, we didn't have as much money as our opponents, and so we relied on video conferencing to do it. We organized 36 counties doing it. It was, again, free. So for that to say that it's a cost, and I'm also, just to reiterate one other point, I don't think it should be lost. There was some concern about this is going to raise costs because of the investment in technology. Technology costs have been drastically falling. And the fact that Medicare or Medicaid allows these to be depreciated over 5 years, as Dr. Knight Richardson mentioned, makes it an office expense. Nothing more, nothing less.
Okay. We have a number of people to testify. Please stay in the room in case we need to call you back. I don't know if you want to stick
around. Sure. Yeah. Thank you.
All right. With that, I would like to call up Kathy Britton, and Chris Schultz and Jackie Rice.
Kathy? Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. First of all, let me tell you a little bit about myself so that I can establish a bit of a basis to why I'm here today. I began in telemedicine.
Introduce yourself.
Excuse me, for the record, I'm Catherine Britton. I'm here on behalf of the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. I began in telemedicine in 1991 when there were four telemedicine programs in the United States, and RodeoNet, a mental health telemedicine program in Eastern Oregon, was one of them. I ran that program. RodeoNet is the reason that mental health telemedicine has such a strong foothold in Eastern Oregon. I have participated in telemedicine at the state level, at the national level. I have been consultant to HHS groups, to Medicare, and to Medicaid about telemedicine. And I have worked with the American Telemedicine Association since its inception, and I serve on the board of the Northwest Regional Telehealth Resource Center. I feel like we have put a lot of time and effort into the thinking about this bill, and the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon has some concerns, not about telemedicine and its efficacy, because heavens knows we're the ones that advocate for that, but we have some concerns about this particular piece of legislation, and I'd like to talk to you about that. I've given you some written testimony. I'm going to expand on that just a bit. I know that you can read, and I would like to not be accused of reading to you. We have a marvelous opportunity in this state right now. We have health care reform under Senate Bill 329 coming, and we have consideration for the use of telemedicine for the first time as a means of improving access to health care and reducing costs. We have a $20.1 million award from the FCC, which the Telehealth Alliance was instrumental in getting, to place telecommunications infrastructure for healthcare throughout the state. And we have the opportunity to create a good quality, well-crafted, well-thought-out, well-vetted reimbursement bill. We think that the work that has been done by Dr. Knight Richardson is an excellent beginning. We think that he is very, very supportive of telemedicine, as are we. We would very much like to engage him in the discussion and have attempted to do so on several occasions. One of the things that I would like to talk about is the whole idea of the universality for telehealth and telemedicine. This particular bill targets rural Oregon. I would like to point out to you that there are many people in urban areas who are just as disenfranchised from access to health care as there are in rural areas. There are people who are in impoverished portions of urban communities that have to take time away from their $8 an hour jobs to drive across town for an hour visit and an hour back without consideration for how they're going to pay for that, maybe having to use public transportation, maybe having to take a sick child or an elder with dementia through that process. There are options available to those folks through the use of telehealth and telemedicine that are just as important to them as are the access issues for rural Oregon. One of the things that is also concerning to me is that I have learned over time that if we want to grow telemedicine and grow telehealth and to engage as many people in the state as possible in its support and practice, we need to involve those people. Last year, when we came to you with concerns about Senate Bill 519, we made a promise to you that we would convene a work group and have a bill ready for you by the 2009 session. We have kept that end of the deal. In November, we convened a work group at the request on behalf of the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon that had 60 people in attendance for 4 hours. 8 of those people were physicians. 7 of those physicians were from OHSU. We had representatives from the insurance division. We had representatives from DHS. We had representatives from the governor's office. And we had representatives from many of the major health facilities across the state. We identified the gaps. We are currently in process of inviting people to participate and to, as we move forward in March, to begin to craft this bill.
Were the insurance carriers there too?
The insurance carriers were not present at that meeting but have been invited to participate going forward. They were invited. They just did not come to that particular session. We intend to work through the issues that surround the reimbursement of telehealth and probably the issues that we may have with each other. But we do believe that working together, what we will do is come up with a bill that everyone can support and everyone can get behind, and that we can move telehealth and telemedicine forward in that way. All we're doing right now is asking you for the opportunity to do that and to bring a bill that does not have unintended consequences to the table, that does not have difficulty with universal support, and that we can go forward without having to worry about having to amend as the technology moves forward and changes. Thank you.
So I would like you to point out, though, for the record, exactly the concerns you have. I mean, we all want telehealth,
yes.
And I definitely want I can see having telehealth going to the rural areas without having it in the metropolitan areas yet until we have the insurance carriers on board that in seeing if this is really going to increase premiums and costs, you know, statewide. So I see how 1100 may be a start, and but I'd like you to specifically state what you had put here, why you don't like this Yeah.
Madam Chair, I'm happy to do that. One of the things that we are concerned about is that we don't lock ourselves into the default Medicare standard, that we look at what is being done in other states and what insurers are paying for in other states, that we explore pilot projects within this legislation that will allow us to gather the data that you're asking for. There's data being gathered on a regular basis in other states that is coming forward. We know, for example, the efficacy of telehealth in urban areas, particularly for chronic disease management. Excuse me. One of the other objections that I have is that it includes language that, I don't have a concern, but I was pointing out where costs would be increased. If you want to pay for all of this, or if the insurers want to pay for all of this, I'm very happy to have them do that. You know, it's fine. But I do think that paying on a routine basis for physician-to-physician consults is going to increase costs. I do believe that paying the provider at the originating site, not for the referral, but for sitting in the room or sitting or for the health professionals to be there and present for the consult, is going to increase cost. I believe that the language that the rates of reimbursement must take into account the investments in technology creates a situation beyond where Medicare and Medicaid pay for the origination site fee. I think that is a known cost, but the whole idea behind the FCC award is to allow for the placement of infrastructure and equipment in facilities so that we don't have to try to recoup our costs from fees for that take into account equipment costs. We don't take those costs into account for other kinds of equipment, and I don't think that that's the situation that we need to get into here. I think that the language in the bill would lead me to believe that video conferencing must be used regardless of whether there is a better tool, a less cost-effective tool, or a more practical tool. And I would like to not have that language in this bill. I have some concerns about the writing of the OARs. I think our insurers have more concerns, but I think that one of my concerns is that having an understanding of telemedicine and the ramifications is real important, and I would just like to see in this bill that that's taken into account and that telemedicine expertise will be garnered in the writing of these rules. Finally, I know that there are service standards for the delivery of all kinds of subspecialty medicine. Those standards are set by the various colleges for cardiology, for radiology, for oncology, and I'm certainly not saying that we should not provide services outside those standards. Quality of service standards for telecommunications, however, is an entirely different story. And while we endeavor to subscribe to the highest standards of quality of service, and we'll do so with this FCC award, to impose that on a small rural clinic that may not be able to afford that quality of service standard, I think is not realistic. I think, finally, we do have an informed consent procedure that many of the folks in the state that are doing telemedicine are using. It's been fully vetted with the ATA and with the Center for Telemedicine Law. So those are my specific concerns as they are stated in the testimony. And With that, I'll be happy to take your questions, Madam Chair, or any of those from your committee.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Thank you very much. It's Ms. Britton. Am I saying that correctly?
Yes.
Well, several things. First of all, I would like to invite Dr. Knight Richardson to comment on the testimony, if he would like to do that.
Yes, I would, Senator.
Please go ahead, and then I'll ask my other questions after that.
Thank you for the opportunity, Senator Gordley, Chair Monis Anderson. I hear what Ms. Britton is saying, and I believe her comments are due to a misunderstanding of what this bill does and does not do. Her first objection said she didn't want us to block ourselves into what Medicare rules were stating. Well, this bill largely uses Medicaid rules, and Medicaid rules are permissive rules. In fact, before I got into suggesting that the state of Oregon have some sort of rule regarding telemedicine, I flew to Washington and talked with the head of Medicaid because I wanted specific guidelines. I didn't want to for us to construct a scenario legislatively that would in fact block us in. And basically what Mr. Smith said at that time was that you have a lot of latitude, but the main focus is you need to be cost neutral, which we have. It needs to provide for quality of care, which we have, by assuring the sites, by assuring the quality of the clinicians, i.e. which clinicians can do direct care, and that it, in fact, be targeted toward populations that were not being served. And that is how we approach this bill. I further investigated all of the rules and have read the laws of the 24 states that allow this. No state of the 24 states that have telemedicine legislation allows for fax or telephone. It just is the case. And nor would Medicaid allow it. Because this bill, once again, it is not a medical informatics bill. And that's where some misunderstanding is going on. This is a bill that is directly related to providing clinical care. And that's what telemedicine is all about. And we have to keep that in focus. It is about what we can do to treat a patient when we can't see them in person face to face. And what, if you met them face to face, would be required. The idea that a fax is somehow involved in that, it still is a reach in my mind. The other objection by Ms. Britton was that the language includes an increase in cost, particularly by allowing the referring physician to charge. It is a rare occasion that the referring physician will need to be in the room with a patient, unless in the case of the pediatric intensivist, where the referring physician is going to be guided in the procedure on that patient by the physician on the other end, what we call the hub. So if the hub physician is guiding, let's say, a endotracheal tube in a premature child by the team at the spoke, well, of course that team is on the other end, and of course they have to be paid for performing the procedure, and the one at the hub has to be paid for actually communicating with that team. So we don't want to not allow that, and Ms. Britton was concerned that we block ourselves in. Well, if you change to the language that she was suggesting, that's exactly what would happen. This bill is permissive. The language is permissive. It's flexible in the language. I believe that's, of course, I may be somewhat prejudiced having read all of this, but it does not do that. And once again, we must remain focused on this as a clinical tool. And she says that that the language does not allow for an expansion in technology. That's not true. It already accounts for technology costs, and this is straight from Medicaid, which simply allows someone, as Senator Atkinson says, it essentially becomes an office expense, which you can depreciate. So I don't see what the concern is there. And a further point that she made, she said this... I already made that point that it is not a medical informatics bill. This is a bill for clinical care, and we have to keep that in focus. In sum, I really have, and I want to hear, I want to hear the meat of the objections, but I don't hear it. I hear that there's a sense that everybody was not at the table when the bill was crafted. They certainly had the opportunity. I was not contacted several times regarding this bill. I was contacted once by Ms. Hoffman to join in some discussions well after those discussions had been planned. So I have wanted to be as involved as possible, but I say once again, telemedicine has been going on in this state a long time. If it's been going on since 1991, why are we at 2008 just now dealing with the bill? To ensure quality. And most of the argument that I hear, they're not arguing for quality, they're concerned about cost. Well, people are dying because they can't get help. I'm impatient with that kind of an argument, and forgive my passion here, but I'm impatient with that. We need to have a bill now establishing the state's ability to not only regulate for the quality of the bill, but to also help people not be so reticent to use it because we don't have a manner relating to the payment of it. And I'll end there.
Thank you, Dr. Knight Richardson. I appreciate those comments for the record. I have two questions. One, I'd like some more information for the record about the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. We do have the printed testimony of Ms. Britton, but it's not clear to me whether this is a membership organization. If it is a membership organization, what does that membership look like? There's no address or contact information on the letterhead that we've been given, so I would just like to know more about the organization that you represent. Additionally, you spoke to an FCC award, and that information isn't in the printed testimony either, and we were moving so quickly, I didn't get the substance of what it is you wanted us to understand about that award and how that award impacts medically underserved communities.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Gordley. You asked about the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon. The Telehealth Alliance of Oregon was formed in 2002. It is a 501c3. It is a membership organization. Its members are made up of people like myself who have been involved directly in developing telemedicine projects. It involves hospitals and health systems such as Peace Health, Oregon Health and Sciences University, Legacy Health Systems, Asante. I'm sorry.
And so it is a membership organization?
It is a membership organization. It is open to anyone who is interested in furthering telehealth and telemedicine in the state of Oregon.
How many member organizations participate?
We have 12 member organizations participating, but we have 146 people that regularly participate on our listserv.
Is OHSU participating as
yes.
a member organization?
Yes. Yes. We have strong support from OHSU. Our chair is from OHSU. Does that provide you with the information you're seeking about the Telehealth Alliance? Do you want some additional?
The other thing I asked
yes,
for was
about
the location.
The location.
Where are you located?
It is a distributed organization. We do not have offices. We do not have paid staff. We have very tired volunteers many times. Our formal mailing address is the home of our treasurer, who is in Gates, Oregon.
So for the record, if we wanted to contact the organization, again, there's no contact information
sure.
on the letterhead, no address, no phone
right.
number, no email. That's what I'm trying to draw out for the record.
I apologize. Excuse me, Senator Gorley. I apologize for that because as I grabbed the logo, I did not grab the letterhead, just the logo, so I apologize.
And the FCC
Award? The FCC Award was a pilot program introduced by the FCC to help to explore whether the rural health care pilot program, and this is going to take a whole lot longer than we have today, but it's a fund set up in the Universal Service Program to reimburse vendors, telecommunications vendors, for costs that they incur in providing telecommunications services to hard-to-serve areas or very expensive areas where it does not make a business sense to do so. Rural health care providers were not taking advantage of that program, and as when you leave money on the table, you know, people look at it and start salivating, and they wanted to make sure that that money did not disappear, and so they opened up a pilot program to allow for the exploration of better ways to utilize that monies, and they made $417 million in awards for over the next 3 years, and those awards are to be invested in infrastructure to rural areas where there is not currently infrastructure and there is not a business case for in putting that infrastructure in place. We put in the award, the Telehealth Alliance for Oregon, working with our colleagues, working with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and many others throughout the state, put an application for that money together, and as a result, received $20.1 million to do that. In doing so, what we want to do is form a full Oregon Health Network. Now, the money will go to rural areas for the investment in infrastructure, but that we do not preclude urban hospitals and urban clinics from participating in the Oregon Health Network so that we have a universal and ubiquitous network in place when we're finished.
Was there something more you wanted to say about that?
Go ahead.
Have the rural areas been identified?
Yes. All of the critical access hospitals, all of the federally qualified health clinics, all of the mental health clinics, all of the public health clinics that are not currently connected or not connected or that need to make connection to the full network are identified in this program.
And those, programs that you're naming, generally speaking, would participate in that $20.1 million
yes, they would.
Grant. And then there's also the possibility that urban areas, generally speaking, again, might participate as well.
Oh, we would want them to participate, and we are in the process of securing participation agreements from them.
Would you make sure that the committee gets some information
Absolutely.
In writing that talks about the...
I've been involved with this $21 million grant, and I think the governor made an announcement in September, October, when we first awarded it, and... we're dealing with some issues regarding match money right now, but that's my frustration in knowing the nexus between this bill and how this can well, maybe there isn't a nexus. I'm not going to worry about that, but we do have that bill. We are and I will have someone come, probably the Hospital Association, come to present also.
Senator Monis Anderson, if I might, I'd like to rebut one of the things that Dr. Knight Richardson has said, and that is not that we are advocating for the payment of fax or phone. We are advocating for the use of the appropriate tool. And if a phone call or a phone session for therapy or for follow-up care can be used in lieu of a video conference, then we feel like that's the appropriate tool that should be used. Should it be paid for? That's not something we're taking a position on. I think down the road we're going to see the same discussion around email. And it's already beginning in other states. And so we're not even talking about that here. The other point I'd like to rebut is that the idea of clinically appropriate sites and boxing those in, we have a whole burgeoning area around telemonitoring and home health care, and the efficacy that is available through the use of that in terms of reducing acute care needs, reducing hospitalizations, and increasing life span. And I think that those are the kinds of things that we don't want this bill to preclude as we go down the road.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I'm Chris Schultz with the Ullum Group representing Peace Health. Last year, I testified about the concerns we had about Senate Bill 519, and we provided suggestions in writing for improving that bill. Those concerns are not reflected in the introduced version of Senate Bill 1100. I think the great thing is we're all interested in working on a telemedicine reimbursement policy. The bad news is all of us and all of our attorneys read the bill differently. And it's possible that we're all wrong, but I think it's more likely that this bill is not super clear and that we all need to sit around a table and spend some time working on it. With me today is Jackie Rice from Peace Health to explain our concerns in more detail.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, my name is Jackie Rice, Director of Business Development with Peace Health. I was involved quite extensively along with our clinical staff, physicians and nursing staff, in providing the administrative and planning support for setting up the telemedicine pilot that is now going on between Dornbecker Children's Hospital at OHSU and Sacred Heart Pediatrics Unit in Eugene. Peace Health has hospitals in Eugene, Florence, and Cottage Grove. With the planned opening of the Riverbend facility in Springfield, we'll be operating four hospitals within 70 miles of each other. Today, Peace Health is using telemedicine to connect patients to those specialists in Portland that I mentioned. And at the end, we'll pass out an article that provides you with more information on that, that pilot. In addition, the clinical staff at both ends of the pilot are collecting extensive data on to track the quality outcomes as well as the financial outcomes of being able to provide this kind of service with Dornbecker pediatric critical care physicians. We also have an interest in reducing clinical trips both by patients all the way from parents of tiny babies up through very elderly patients and physicians between our four hospitals. The intent of Senate Bill 1100 is good. We support telemedicine and want to see a state policy on reimbursement that works. Unfortunately, the language of the bill doesn't work. In addition to concerns expressed by the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon and the insurers, we are extremely concerned that if this bill passes, it will set clinically limiting provisions that defeat the whole purpose of telemedicine. Two provisions of the bill that would limit the use of telemedicine. One, the goal should be expanded beyond underserved communities. The bill limits telemedicine to medically underserved areas and geographic areas where there is a shortage of such specialists. That's on page 1, lines 12 through 14. Peace Health respectfully suggests that the goal should be expanded to improving timely access to specialty medical services or in lieu of transferring the patient to another medical facility. And I think every speaker here today has talked about improving access to health care in some form or another. Two, delete requirement for rule requiring face-to-face visits within a reasonable distance. The bill requires the rules to prohibit the use of telemedicine when a face-to-face consultation is available within a reasonable distance from the patient's home or work. For the reasons outlined above, specifically reducing vehicle trips, we recommend this provision be deleted. That's on page 2, lines 38 through 41. If the bill is approved in its current form, PCELF will not be able to be reimbursed for telemedicine services. The bill would be more limiting than existing law. We pointed out this flaw last April, but the language has not changed. We recommend that the committee set aside Senate Bill 1100 and direct all the interested parties to work this out for 2009. And PCELF looks forward very much to collaborating with all the stakeholders on this. Thank you. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Again, just some more information from the witness. What is the Ullum Group and where is it located?
Oh, I'm sorry. The Ullum Group is a public affairs and public relations firm based in Eugene, and we're members of the Capital Club and registered to lobby the legislature.
And then also we have the testimony on Peace Health partial letterhead. There's no contact information, email address, street address. Can you provide that for the record as well?
Would you like me to just verbalize that right now?
Please.
Okay. Peace Health, 770 East 11th Avenue, Eugene, Oregon, 97401, area code 541-686-3660. And my email address is jrice@peacehealth.org.
And this is a membership organization?
This is a health system.
Hospital.
And we own and operate the four hospitals I mentioned in addition to a multi-specialty medical group.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I'm asking the detailed questions because in my experience, we fail in our process to get this kind of information on the record. It's wonderful that we have witnesses come before us who have certain expertise and say to us that they're representing certain interests, et cetera, but we need to probe a little further than we usually do. And for the record, but also for the listening public who have no idea what it is we're talking about sometimes because we're talking inside language, inside ball. So that's why I'm trying to lay down that information today. What do you say to, so we wait a year. What happens to and for people in medically underserved communities, rural communities in particular, who need access and perhaps a life-saving service right now? What do they do for a year?
I could give an example with that. If it was smaller communities such as our hospital in Florence, Peace Harbor Hospital in Florence, or perhaps Cottage Grove, they would go to the emergency department there. They would be evaluated at that emergency department. And first of all, let me say I'm not a physician or a nurse, so I'm giving you my perspective on it, and the others here might wish to clarify it. But that patient would be evaluated by that emergency department physician at that facility, and a decision may be made to transport to a more tertiary facility, such as Sacred Heart Medical Center in Eugene. That's a Peace Health facility. And they would then call that emergency department and consult with an emergency department physician there and perhaps a specialist. Let's say the patient was having a stroke in that outlying hospital and get in touch with a neurologist and consult with them on whether the patient should be transported over. And this would be by telephone. And with the, I was just going to say, with the telemedicine capability, that neurologist would be able to visually, over the telemedicine equipment, look at that patient and can tell a lot by visually whether what kind of stroke is occurring and through questioning and decide if they need to be transported and what treatment needs to be initiated at the remote facility.
Okay. All right. Dr. Knight Richardson, I wish that you had this testimony. We will make sure that this is faxed or email, probably faxed.
We could scan this and email it to him.
Email. Would you like that?
Yes, Senator, I think that would be very, very helpful.
All right.
Madam
yes.
Chair, I'd like Ms. Brinton to respond to that question because I think it's already going on.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, telemedicine is already occurring in many places in Oregon in different forms to meet different needs. Is it being reimbursed? Not always. But in a lot of instances it is because, as you heard, Regents currently reimburses to the Medicare standard. The state Medicaid fee-for-service reimburses on a very broad basis. There are LifeWise Health System reimburses on a very broad basis. There are other providers that reimburse, and they don't even want to know that it's telemedicine, just submit the bill and they pay it. Unfortunately, what we end up is with no track record on how that gets reimbursed. One of the things that we are struggling with is that we originally thought that we could, by visiting each of these insurers, establish a telemedicine reimbursement policy. That was the result of the conversation that we had following the passage of HDR4, which was the policy statement around telemedicine reimbursement back in 2001. One of the things we discovered is that there are over 800 insurers who reimburse for health care in Oregon, and it began to feel very overwhelming. Plus, people were reimbursing for different things. They were requiring different codes. They wanted, they wanted information submitted on different forms. And we thought, well, this needs some universal look to it, because our billers and our coders at hospitals were going, we're not even going to try this because we don't know how to respond to each of these. So, yes, telemedicine is going on, and it's growing rapidly, and what we need to do is to put a standard reimbursement policy and procedure in place for the state of Oregon so that it can continue to grow in a robust fashion. Thank you for asking. And, by the way, Senator Gourley, 50523 Linwood Drive, Gates, Oregon, 97063 for the Telehealth Alliance of Oregon.
I appreciate that. I'm going to want Senator Atkinson to come back, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. We have one more. I would like Fawn McNeely to just go over the testimony that is before you from the legislative advocates, and just go over that briefly so that we get that on the record, and then we'll bring the senator up, and I want to make a few comments too.
Okay. Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fawn McNeely, representing the ODS Companies, health insurance company in Portland. I've submitted to you testimony from Mike Dewey, which goes over several of the issues that have already been addressed. I do believe that John Powell discussed the section that talks about how the rules would have to be modified. I think that that would take care of some of our concerns with the reimbursement rates. Just to go through this, Section 2 discusses healthcare professionals, and we feel like this is a pretty broad scope. Not only would it be the 20 different licensing boards, but the bill specifically says telemedicine means using telecommunications technology to deliver healthcare services, included but not limiting to clinical diagnosis, clinical services, patient consultation, and the practice of medicine across state lines. We feel like that's a pretty broad list of services and that it's not limited in scope. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I will need some feedback regarding definition of healthcare professional, if this would need to be more carefully codified, as well as definition of rural area. And I'm still I want to start somewhere, and I'm not. And rural is nice. I understand the issues that Eugene has. I understand the issues of the metro area, and we definitely need it. And that's why I sort of go along with what Kathy Britton says. It would be nice if we all got to the table and started having something for the whole state. But we also have to have the carriers on board to make sure that the reimbursement rates are on. And the other issue I'm having a problem with is we're asking DCBS, the Department of Consumer and Business Affairs, and DHS, the Department of Human Services, to they're a big part of this bill, and they have not testified at all. And so before I'm willing to move the bill, we need to have them at the table also, and I'm not sure how much they have even been involved with the telehealth, the ORTC, I'm just not sure how much integration they've all had with this particular bill also.
And Madam Chair, I would like to say, Chris brought up the fact that there are a number of different interpretations of what the bill actually does, and I tend to agree with him on that. We've heard Dr. Norwood Richardson say some things about it being limited in scope. We don't see it as limited in scope.
Madam Chair,
yes. Senator Morrison.
Thank you. Were you at the conference?
We were not included in the work group.
Were you invited?
No, we were not.
So what you're telling us now, you did not have an opportunity to discuss with
We did not know that there was a work group going on addressing this issue.
Now, you represent, again?
ODS companies.
ODS, okay.
And
would you give us your address, please?
It's actually on
the letterhead. It's on the letterhead. Okay.
And we would be more than happy to work on this issue in the interim. ODS fully supports telemedicine. We actually do pay for and reimburse telemedicine services on a limited basis.
Well, the reimbursement, getting DCBS and DHS involved in this, I know everybody, you have a fiscal statement in front of you, so at least it's been sent to DHS. I see Jim Edge in the background. I don't know if he's keeping his head down or not, but I do really feel that we also need to have input from the agencies and getting their feedback also regarding reimbursement and setting rates and adopting rules for this bill.
And Section 4 of the bill does say the rates of reimbursement must take into account investments in technology needed to practice telemedicine. We do believe that that would increase costs.
Okay, Senator Atkinson, get back up here. I was really wanting to move this bill, but I'm not comfortable yet with all of the information that's been put forward yet.
Madam Chair, for the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator from Southern Oregon. If I may just say a few things. This is very frustrating for a variety of reasons. First of all, you've heard from PR groups and lobby groups and insurance carriers, but not one of them has talked about the people who actually need the care. This is nothing more than a very ridiculous turf war that I think that you've just seen witnessed. As far as there being work groups and interim meetings and all that, I haven't. If I received the emails, I apologize, they never got to my screen. So I find this to be ridiculous because we wrote this bill in particular for rural Oregon, which is about to run out of their federal money. And when their federal money runs out, we've already, last session when we were here, we were closing libraries. We've talked about our need to close our police and our jails. And do you think for 1 minute we're not going to close our mental health services? And the first place that we're going to ask, those counties are going to ask, is for Salem to be involved. And Salem, as you all know, has had lots of interim task groups and work groups and stakeholder meetings and lots of meetings and still doesn't have an answer. And so what we did is we set out to create a bill that has been working for Katrina victims before we had Katrina victims in Southern Oregon or in Eastern Oregon. That's why we have the bill. Now, this $21 million red herring is just that. It's a red herring. That bill, that amount, does not factor into this bill at all. That is a red herring. It does not factor into this bill at all. You just heard what happens. What happens to the people who need services right now when the federal funding, if it doesn't come through, what happens to those people? Go to the ER. Go to the ER. 6 and 7 years ago, when all of us were in this building, we were talking about the problem of people going to the ER, increasing the cost of health insurance. Do you remember those conversations? I sure do. And that's the answer. If we don't pass this now, let's work on it in the interim. Let's have a bunch of meetings. Let's come back in 09. Let's go through 09, maybe wait 6 or 7 months for session to end, for enabling language to start on January 1st, 2010. And then maybe we'll all have everybody together. If you need mental health services or any other services in those interims, well, you're out to lunch, go to the ER. You're out of luck. Dr. Nye Richardson has talked about the fact that this will not increase costs. He also talked about the ability to move this as a business expense. If any of you want to see how this works in a non-clinical environment, come to my desk on the floor. I will show you how iChat works. It is ridiculously simple. Last year, in a war zone, I was in Iraq, talking to my son wirelessly as he was taking his evening bath. I'm in a war zone on the other side of the world. My son's in his bathtub. It works. It's simple. A now five-year-old uses it. As far as the rulemaking authority, certainly we're open to work. But you know what? Let's keep this all. Let's get this back to the human level for just a minute. Back to the human people. The people that we represent. There's none of us up here, me or any of you, that are working for PR groups. Let's refocus for a second. And that is that we're about to have a bunch of Oregonians who need this. Why in the world would we not connect Oregonians who need it to a world-class medical facility called Oregon Health Science University that is already providing this to members in other states? Why wouldn't we?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Morsett.
Are you suggesting that administrative rules would solve this problem? If this bill was passed, that administrative rules would step in and solve it enough for it to work?
Well, it's a reimbursement bill. These people are still going to have issues when they go into a clinical setting, if their facility does not have the technology for video conferencing, it's still not going to happen. And this other $21 million we're talking about, that, you're right, that doesn't have anything to do with reimbursement of services provided. That, though, is going to be actually setting up ways of communication between hospitals and mental health organizations and FQHCs. And so
you don't think that administrative rules would allow this program to get started?
They would need more direction from us regarding, that's why I need to have a conversation with DHS and DCBS that are going to be the ones who will set up and adopt rules, because I don't know that answer. Okay. Yeah.
And they're not here right now.
Well, do you want to talk?
Oh,
yeah.
Here.
Well, I
they're
see
here.
Jim
they're
Edge,
here
and he is coming
okay.
up.
We right. smoked him out.
I would say I don't think that Senator Atkinson has finished his statement, and I do want to return mm-hmm. to what he is trying to get us to understand about the impact on people who are already hurting and in dire straits in those counties, and I want to get us back to that.
Madam Vice Chair, thank you. One last point that was brought up. Email was a red herring that was just thrown out, that we're going to serve people clinical care by email, and that this bill does not address that. That should be stricken from your minds, if not from the record. This is a clinical care bill. That's how it's written. That's a red herring. So there are people that need the help. And there's it's a turf war. So if Peace Health wants to get out, because they, I understand, I remember working with them last session. Unfortunately, they never contacted me until they got me in the hall on Monday and said, by the way, we're going to oppose your bill. Like it's me or something. We're actually working with some folks here that need the help. If they want to be out, if they want to work on their own interim bill, fine. What I'm concerned about is when federal funding runs out, we have some counties that are in dire, dire straits. Wheeler County, Curry County, Coos County, Jackson, Josephine, Klamath, Lake County, that rely on those timber payments. And those timber payments uphold things like community health, public safety, all the way down occasionally to libraries. And they're all being cut, cut, cut. And if we have interim work groups, and we're already in the interim, mind you, but if we wait until 2010, that's ridiculous. Here is a way to help somebody that has been pioneered. Dr. Knight Richardson can speak to with authority. You have the assurances of having it clinically set up to work, and we're going to get it mired down in things that don't relate to this bill. That's wrong, and I would urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you. And yes, federal funding is coming, is decreasing, but the federal funding won't affect reimbursement rates.
I'm talking about federal funding as it relates to community health and rural health at the county level. If you go to Jackson County Mental Health Services, which is part of what I'm talking about, the federal funding through the ONC County, and that money isn't there. Now my county commissioners have to make a choice between that program or sheriff's patrol.
Yeah. But that's
the decision that's coming up.
Okay. Jim Edge. Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Edge. I'm the administrator of the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in the Department of Human Services. We fully support telemedicine and feel that it's part of the way medicine should be delivered in the future. It's part of the wave of the future. It's the direction we're moving. You'll see from our fiscal analysis of this bill that our analysts who've looked at it do feel that there is some cost to implementing this the way this bill is written. And actually, they've so far only listed it as an indeterminate cost. They feel that there is some cost. There probably also is some long-term savings. There probably is some efficiencies to telemedicine that will be maybe a little longer term than the initial costs of implementing some of these things. Our only concern is that the initial costs would come first and might cause us to have to relook at the per capita costs in our managed care calculations of the rates we pay our managed care plans, and there would be some cost to us. But we're fully supportive of the concept of telemedicine.
In the bill, it has you and DCBS setting up rules in rate setting, and I really need to have some feedback from you regarding how you would work with the insurers regarding reimbursing health professionals, because this has always been a carrier role, and I'm not quite sure how this is now going to work, and I feel we need to have the health insurer carriers and you working together to see if this concept can work.
And Madam Chair, we have not done that to this point. We haven't discussed with DCBS the implementation of how these rules might look.
Yes, Senator Morissette.
Okay. Does that preclude being able to do it if this bill is... Okay, first of all, if this bill is passed, it may go to Ways and Means. Unknown result. Secondly, if it's passed and we rely on administrative rules to get us started on this, can that be done, do you think? I mean, I understand what everybody is saying, and I think that eventually has to happen, but I'm wondering, though, if we can use administrative rules, if we can get it out of Ways and Means, to...
Well, actually, I would I wish we just had one more week so we could have DCBS and DHS and the carriers get together to let us know how this can work, because I still think it's a great idea. I see Corey, would you please come up and from DCBS and introduce yourself, and are you aware of this bill at all, or can you comment?
Madam Chair, for the record, Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and yes, I am aware of the bill in general terms, and I understand the issue that you're addressing is the provision in Section 3 sub 4 dealing with the coordinated rulemaking between DCBS and DHS. That's where you are. I had a brief hallway conversation with one of the insurance carrier representatives who mentioned that they were concerned about the requirement that the DCBS rules have to be consistent with the DHS rules. And my understanding is that the nature of the concern, and again, I haven't been in any detailed discussions of this, my understanding is the nature of the concern was that because the DHS rules deal with reimbursement and the DCBS rules do not, that they were concerned that that might require DCBS to get into areas that DCBS normally would not get into. We would always coordinate with DHS. And, again, I know time is tight, and I have not had the opportunity to talk to members of the industry about the nature of their concerns or to consult with DHS other than to flag the issue across the table for 2 seconds earlier in the week saying, I understand there's an issue. We would always coordinate, and if the bill directs us to coordinate, that might be the right middle ground. Make sure that we coordinate but not specifically require that they be consistent, because there may be reasons for inconsistencies. So with very little preparation, that's the best I can offer at the moment.
What I would like to do is, I'm not giving up yet, but we only have until 10 o'clock Monday, and today is Friday. And including Senator Atkinson, Dr. Knight, Norwood Knight Richardson, the insurance carriers, I don't know if you'd be able to just flesh out exactly what is in here, but that would mean drafting, if maybe this will work without drafting any amendments, or maybe it can, like Senator Morissette was saying, in the rulemaking, but there needs to be some clear understanding regarding the coordination of this between the carriers, DHS and DCBS. And if we can flesh that out before Monday,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
I think we need, we would have to include in the rules or the bill that we're going to come back and work on this. We'll continue working on it. But I think if we can get started, and I agree, the feds are going to cut rural hell. The money to the counties is going to go away, and that will impact across the board. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there is a problem with, for instance, my hospital, Peace Health, in my city, Springfield, has some concerns about this. I want to honor their concerns and want to be able to look at this issue. That should not prevent this bill from moving ahead, I don't think, if we come back and fix it. So that's what I'm hoping we can do, is figure out a way to implement with, but that's going to be up to you guys trying to get together and come back on Monday, if we're going to move it by then.
Dr. Gordley.
Thank you very much. You know, we really do need to move forward. And I want to go back to the sense of urgency that Senator Atkinson and Dr. Knight Richardson are asking us to grasp, the sense of urgency about what is already happening in those counties and what's going to be coming. When the Titanic hit that iceberg, they didn't have enough lifeboats. We need to be, as policymakers, we need to be looking not just at the dollars and cents of the matter and the reimbursement, you know, all of that aside, that matters. It has this place. Mm-hmm. But we are also talking about human needs that exist right now. And in Dr. Knight Richardson's opening statement, he gave the example of doing a diagnosis and saving someone's life, someone that was having a stroke, I believe he said. That's where I'm placing the emphasis. It's on the people who have a need right now in those medically underserved rural communities who, if we do not act, if we fail to act, will continue to go underserved, and all those all the conditions they face in their communities are going to be exacerbated again by the lack of funding that we know is going to be the situation in these counties. So we've got to act and figure out the other details after that. I think we have enough information to act on. I'm comfortable moving forward. And Madam Chair, I understand that you're in a different place, but I'm asking us to focus on the human needs, which so often get lost in this process. We are the Health and Human Services Committee. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I am willing to give my cell phone to let you've got to let me know quickly, and we have, and I don't know if amendments need to be required or not, but if you can at least look and get together with the carriers and then get back with me on where you're at with this issue, I would appreciate it. But Ms. Stresinger, what were you going to say?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm just also due next door also on a hearing that's finishing up, so I was wondering if you needed me anymore, but we will be happy to do that.
And I'll be in this afternoon if you want to touch base with me. I'll be on the floor if you need to get a hold of me.
Okay. All right. Follow up. Thanks.
All right. Okay, so we will be scheduling Senate Bill 1100 for a work session. For Monday, but we will be having invited testimony. And Sandy, you sort of know who the players are, correct?
Yes.
So that will, all right. Any other information for the good of the order? All right, we're adjourned.
Dr. Knight Richardson.